Good morning and welcome everyone to Live Dharma Sunday for September 3rd, 2017. Koyo Kobosa here. So very, very glad you joined us on this Labor Day weekend. Boy, the summer flew by. Central California, we're having a heat wave, triple digits, dry heat, but it's still hot. And yesterday, on Saturday, we had a visitor to Bright Dawn Center here, Reverend Dr. Ron Nakasone and his wife Irene, and they had a visitor from Japan. She's an associate professor at Hyogo University and in religious studies. And she was doing, I'm not sure how long her stay was, but she's going to return to Kyoto, Osaka area pretty soon. And she was doing research on Buddhism in Chicago. And so she went to Chicago and visited some temples there So through our connection with the Nakasones, he said, well, we'd like to come visit. They were going to visit some people in Fresno, mutual friends they knew, prior Jodo Shinshu minister, Jim Yanagihara, who's in assisted living facility there, and then this and that. And Nakasones are from the Bay Area, in the Fremont area, but 3-hour drive, and he's the one who did the calligraphy demonstration workshop where the last induction we had. So he was familiar with our setup here, and so he thought it'd be good to bring Professor Honda to Bright Dawn, and we had a very nice visit. And Reverend Nakasone is originally from Hawaii. So we were talking about Hawaii and about, the Jodo Shinshu scene, I guess you could call it, the ministers and whatnot. And we were sharing memories of Al Bloom, sensei, who had passed away. And then, in fact, they were having a live streaming of his memorial service in Hawaii on Saturday, and I just read an email this morning that one of his good friends, she's listens in to this broadcast, I know, and she's part of the LM10 group, and she was joining that live streaming that the Bloom family, he has a daughter and wife, as surviving family members, and also son, but they live stream, and so a lot of people, he was so prominent, University of Hawaii Emeritus, he was a former dean of the Institute of Buddhist Studies, the IBS in Berkeley, and has written many books, so he was a giant as a Jodo Shinshu minister and a scholar, first-rate scholar. He wrote an autobiography of his life, fascinating background, and time is relentless, moves on, generations move on, and but my point was, just this morning, she was sharing the fact that from this far distance, people could go to the live streaming, and they had a little button you could push. This is that you could then say hello to El Sensei and let him know that you're present. And that's a pretty nice touch, I thought. And it made me think that, because Reverend Nakasona was saying, you know, the voice is something very powerful. And others have said this too in the past, where at a memorial service or funeral, and, you know, you rarely hear the deceased's voice. And that's something to think about, whether I know it would be very powerful. Have you ever been to a service, where a memorial service or funeral, where the family, as part of the service, had played so that you could hear the deceased's voice? I wonder whether, what kind of experience that would be. You know, you certainly would feel his presence. Okay, well, maybe make too many people cry, but the voice, well, anyway, I was thinking about that, and I don't know. I haven't even written a will or anything, but I do have some ideas about my service. I haven't given a lot of thought, of course, but, you know, I should. Everyone should. Okay. And, well, of course, some people even have their funeral service when they're still alive. Is it? I don't want to miss out on the celebration. Well, you know, all kinds of religious experiences. Well, I'm going to introduce a Dharma Glimpse guest, Morris Sekyo Sensei, LM3, and he's doing good work in Florida. So let us hear from Morris Sekyo Sensei.
Hello, it's nice to be able to share a Dharma glimpse with you today. I wasn't always a Buddhist. My family's a Protestant Christian, and when I was a kid, we went to church. Some of these churches would have revivals once in a while, where they'd set aside a week or so when people would go to services every night to reaffirm their dedication to their spiritual life. And back then, there were these traveling religious groups who'd come into town, set up a big tent, kind of like a circus tent. They'd have what they'd call a tent revival. These were a big deal. They always had good speakers, and they'd have great singers and maybe a gospel quartet or something like that. Wasn't much to do in these little West Texas towns where I grew up. No internet, two or three TV stations in most areas. So people would go, if nothing else, just because it was kind of entertaining. I have an uncle that I really didn't like very much when I was a kid. In fact, I was terrified of him. He worked as a roughneck in the oil fields, which is hot, hard work. And he was a roughneck at home, too. Whenever I had to stay with my cousins, he would glower all through dinner, and I was really afraid of his temper. My uncle had absolutely no interest in religion, but my aunt wanted to go to this tent revival, so he took her. And one night, something the preacher said got through to him. My uncle looked at his life and didn't like what he saw. He made a vow to start over, to live a renewed, righteous life. Well, a few nights later, my uncle was awakened in the middle of the night by a noise. He got out of bed to investigate, went into the kitchen. So look, I'm telling you this story as I heard it. I'm not going to say it's true or it's not true, but this is what I was told. He turned on the light in the kitchen, and the devil was in there, hiding behind the refrigerator. The devil attacked my uncle. They wrestled, and my uncle won. Having defeated the devil, he was able to live the rest of his life, a changed man. I have no idea what actually happened in that kitchen that night. There is no doubt my uncle was truly transformed. He became a kind, friendly, funny person. He went from being the relative I liked least and was terrified of to one of my favorite relatives. He even worked his way into management in the oil company. That was over 50 years ago, and this transformation has stuck with him ever since. He remains devout in his faith, but he doesn't talk about it very much. He doesn't have to. He lives his spirituality. There's no need to talk the talk. He walks the walk. If you put that in Buddhist terms, you might say that during that revival, he got a glimpse into his true nature. And as a result of that moment, he went on to purify his karma with actions based on that nature. I might call it Buddha nature. He might call it the Holy Spirit. True transformations rarely happen when things are going well. I read William James years ago, and in the varieties of religious experience, he pointed out that we usually become most aware of the sacred when we're most in need of it. I imagine it's easy to feel transformed when you're listening to a really impassioned sermon in a tent revival, but the real transformation happens when you go back to reality, when you're alone in the kitchen at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you're forced to confront your own demons. Many of us long to discard habits and attitudes that weigh us down in exchange for lighter, more expressive ways of interacting with our world. At its heart, our Buddhist practice should offer this chance to create a renewed, more purposeful, freer life. My uncle and I no longer practice the same religion, but he's still an example to me because he still demonstrates that true transformation is possible if you only walk the walk.
Very, very nice. I couldn't help thinking as I listen to how different approaches or different religions have different techniques to make an impact, to where you have to testify or something that shakes somebody up, you know. And I wonder whether, you know, whether this is evangelical types of things or emotional things, and maybe Buddhism is kind of abstract, dry, and more philosophical, and appeals to educated intellectual, you know, rather than real emotional kind of religious experience. But I thought about, well, I know that Sekyo Sensei is active in the Todo Institute, Greg Creech's work with the Nikon method. And that has an element of that where very, you know, traditional, based in Jodo Shinshu, they call it warm. Some of the Japanese therapies might be more rooted in Zen, which and as you describe the techniques, it's kind of cool in terms of the emotionality. And one of the techniques in Nikon, which means inner reflection, the literal translation means inner reflection, which is the Buddhist MO or modus operandi of, you know, what is their method to look within, self-introspection, self-reflection, to know who you are or what you are, or, and there's a big emphasis on gratitude, particularly, well, the three questions are, the technique is you if they have a workshop, you go and you just reflect all day. They have a kind of a support system, and you have to verbally report on what you found inside yourself. But there's no dialogue. You're behind a sort of a shoji screen, and a listener comes, and then you sort of exchange. It's not a social thing, but you say, hey, you know, I want to give my, I don't know what they call it in Japanese, but, you know, I want to share what I'm just experiencing right now. Okay. And quite often, the part of the technique is to focus on all kinds of things. But when you focus on people, one of the traditional ones, the first one to do is your mother. What did she do for you? That's the first question. Okay. And how much trouble did you cause her? Okay. And and how much did you give back? Okay. This is sort of a, you know, I'm thinking of a financial or monetary analogy where it's like a, you know, assets and liabilities. Okay, what did you receive that enriched your life? You know, what kind of debt do you owe? You know, the cash flow situation. And usually you'll find that you receive so much and you didn't give back much. You know, you were greedy. And it doesn't matter whether the other person was kind and doing something for you. It's just that, you know, because you have a relation, some kind of relationship, that things happen. So it's not about intentionality of things. You think of all the things that she did that you received, okay, that helped you and so forth, okay, regardless of whether they intended to do it for you as a mother or as a friend or as a coworker or as, or, you know, but especially a mother, you and you didn't mean to deliberately cause trouble, cause problems, make her life difficult, but you did. She had to make you lunch every day. She had to, you know, all these things. I did a real quick, it was about a half an hour workshop, Nikon workshop at a Jodo Shinshu convention on Labor Day weekend, Eastern District. You know, we're in Chicago, and they had an annual Labor Day, they still do, EBL, Eastern Buddhist League. And one time I was one of the presenters for a workshop, and I did a Nikon workshop, and I had the three questions, and we were in, you know, there's about 40, 50 people in the hotel room, and I had them all face the wall, just do it individually, told them the questions. I had a handout, then I said, okay, go with the first question, okay, and I rang the bell, and I only timed it about 10 minutes, okay. Regular Nikon, you talk a long time. I mean, you know, the session is all day, okay. This is only 10 minutes, okay. What did you receive from your mother? Okay. And I rang the bell, and I said, okay, now do the second question, okay. What kind of trouble, difficulties did you, you know, cause your mom? Okay. How much, what did you give? Did you show, did you reciprocate any kindness and, you know, so forth, give back and everything? Another 10 minutes. You know, this is real quick. But I dimmed the lights. And, you know, a lot of people are reaching for Kleenex. You know. I mean, even if your mother is gone, passed away, you still have a relationship with her, you know. The relationship doesn't end when someone passes away. Huh? And you could still give back, okay, by how you live your life. There's a transformation that's possible, okay. I was amazed at, you know, the impact with this short thing. Gee, I wonder how, you know, more full-blown type of retreat. And then I thought about the encounter groups. Now, here you're getting into a little bit, well, maybe a kind of a controversial aspect, where if you don't have a good trained leader, because you're dealing with negative emotions, and if there's some unstable people, participants, And there was a Then I was reminded of that there was a Buddhist Dorje Shinshu minister named Reverend Haguri, long time passed away now, from Japan. He came to the BCA and he was active in a lot of California temples. And he was at Fresno for a number of years, way before my time. But he had what could be called a Haguri method. He is very unique. And what he would do is sort of like a Catholic confession technique, and sort of like an encounter group technique too. Sort of like Fritz Perls, if you know of Gestalt therapy. Fritz Perls had this kind of method where he had a hot seat and a small group method where person in the hot seat, you know, is subjected to extreme honesty in emotional expression. But here's how good he method. He utilizes family. He goes into the home. And of course, the family and every participants all agree. They know what's going on. It's not an ambush or a surprise. And so let's say one family member, say it's Uncle Henry. That's what it reminded me of when in the Dharma glimpse. The family members question Uncle Henry. And he, to break him down, says, you know, maybe the children say, Dad, you know, this and this and this. You talk mean a lot of times or something. Or you don't treat mom. Okay. And then, I mean, who knows better the sore points than family members? Huh? Say, and he has, you know, he's in the middle of a circle. I don't know if they really did that physically, but there's no escape. It's relentless to where you say, oh, geez, I guess I never really thought about it, or I took this for granted or whatever. And I'm sort of giving a personal accounting of a relative here, okay, of the story I heard, okay. And I remember my cousins, who's my age, they were children when this happened, you know, young children. They said, Uncle Henry, something happened last night with Uncle Henry. I mean, you know, these children, they knew something big happened, just some kind of transformation. They didn't know exactly, but okay. I wonder, you know, this kind of a confession method is, you can imagine why it's kind of controversial. And of course, encounter groups was more extreme too, where the purpose is to bring up all those negative emotions in a supportive, I mean, it's your family, atmosphere. Okay. Maybe sometimes it's easier with strangers to bare your soul or whatever. I know that I read this someplace, so I guess it must be accurate, but there was one of the encounter group workshop retreats that held at Esalen near Big Sur. So maybe it's kind of the California scene, you know, in the 60s, that he was known for. You have a small group of people, and if you're going to really bond and be honest, he said, first thing, everyone take off your clothes. I mean, if you want to talk about getting rid of inhibitions, you know, getting physically naked is a dramatic commitment or decision. And now, are you going to share honest emotions? Well, if you got naked, I can't imagine these kinds of encounter groups and the kind of dangers that they might pose, but your inner teacher, you yourself, the individual, him or herself, knows when he's a fake, when he's a facade, this and that. Not like a falling leaf showing front and showing back. Okay? What is your back porch like? We know what your front door and front porch looks like. You take as good care of your back porch when no one's going to see it, in terms of when visitors come, or you know, that's the only time we vacuum and clean the house, isn't it? When company's coming, you know, all these things. Where's the naturalness? Can we? Well, you could see where transformation. You know, wow, that's how. has to be genuine, and I think we all have an inner teacher. Okay? Not to talk about inner child, inner teacher, you know, inner parent or whatever, and those kind of psychological dynamics of different approaches and things. But taking away that social type of what retreat workshop or Hagudi method or you know encounter groups or a revival type of a thing, you know. To the extent when we're all alone, our own single, private, individual retreat, solitary thing, come face to face with oneself, and challenge oneself. Your inner teacher can say, "Hey, show me something. Can you walk the walk?" Okay, talking to yourself, huh? I think anything that promotes this, okay, And if it's not something, well, I don't know if you want to call it negative, but an emotional type of an experience, then you're probably just going through some kind of motions, okay? But you will never, nothing will arise from your subconscious, if you want to put it that way, that you can't handle. You produced it. Okay, sometimes I think people are kind of, you know, so something might come up and, you know, I think, you know, you'll never bring something up for yourself that you can't handle. And you have to have that open attitude to yourself. But this is something that I often thought about, and I don't know how to take another step on this in terms of, you know, incorporation for myself, or if I find something some way valuable for myself, how to share it and things like this. But these are all things that sort of triggered off associations and memories that I had when I listened to today's Dharma Glimpse, and something to think about. So that's all for today's broadcast. Till next time, keep going, and you have a wonderful day. Thank you.